Gerard Collins is a former Minister for Justice and for Foreign Affairs. Gerard Collins, you would have dealt with Mrs. Thatcher across the table. I think you were in government when she became a Prime Minister. I think you were Minister for Justice at the time. She wasn't the easiest to deal with, but I suppose you knew where you stood with her.
Firstly, let me say, Sean, that I'm really sad to hear the news of her demise, because she was, during her day, an exceptionally important person, not just in the British government sense, but also in the European and the international front. She was a major, major figure and an exceptionally able person. I did have meetings with her now and again, and I was often at the receiving end of a lashing, if you like, but that was part of par for the course, and I never minded that. She was very, very clear in her focus and on her objectives, and I'm talking now as European as well as not just Ireland, and she was exceptionally determined in achieving her objectives, and I found on a personal side of things that she could be very intimidating. More particularly with her own ministers, who actually, showed it quite clearly at times. I think I only saw one minister ever from her government to stand up to her and tell her, you know, where to get off, if you like, and that was Lord Peter Carrington. And I think she respected him, maybe probably more so because he did that. In the European scene, Sean, she was very uncomfortable in Europe during my time because of the extent of the socialist prime ministers that she had to deal with. There were quite a number of them in Germany and France and the bigger countries at the time. And she felt that she was being dragged as a Tory conservative down that socialist road and that her economy wouldn't stand up to it.
She famously, I think, came to Dublin to a European summit during an Irish presidency with a very simple message: I want my money back, the start of the row of the British rebate.
Yeah, and she could bang the table on that one, and she did get her way back, you know. And in fact, she remarked to me one day after another meeting in Dublin Castle, where she didn't achieve any great success at the time, as she was on her way to the plinth for the family photograph. I was quite near her at the time, and she said, "That was a damn fine castle we left you, Collins." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, you left in a bit of a hurry, didn't you?" she hadn't a great sense of humour now. I didn't even get a wry smile at that particular time, but I never minded that. In relation to us, Sean, dealing with Northern Ireland, she never really could understand the extent of the security effort we were putting in to try and deal with the problems of the day. We were never given the credit for that, even though that we could clearly show that the cost to our taxpayers was about five times the cost of what it was to her taxpayers for her effort. And she could never really understand or accept that we had a judicial system of our own through which applications for extradition had to be dealt with. And we had difficulties in that area as well. You know, we are a sovereign state, and I think more than once I had to say that on British television, which people were looking in rather amazement at it. But nevertheless, she was a great leader, a powerful leader for her people and for her country. She did contribute a certain amount in the European scene because she brought a balance to it, I think, that was needed at the time. And as I say, we were all better. She certainly did a lot.
Gerard Collins, thank you very much indeed for those recollections and reminiscences about Mrs. Thatcher. Seamus Mallon, the former Deputy First Minister and former Deputy Leader of the SDLP, is on the line. Seamus Mallon, would you say, I mean, Mrs. Thatcher was clearly obsessed with security matters in the early part of her premiership, but did she change? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of the lead up to the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 1985.
Well, I think certainly I viewed her as somebody from the extreme right wing of the Conservative Party. And when you looked at some of our colleagues and our close people there, you would realise just how right-wing that was. That was reflected in her attitude to Ireland as a whole. I mean, in reality, she still saw the government of Ireland as part of a colony, and the Republic of Ireland as still something to be ruled by Britain. And it took quite some time getting to grips with the fact that there was a sovereign government here, that the sovereign government had a right to take an interest and to seek a solution, and more importantly, maybe, that sovereign government had a right to be part of the solution. And that was the enormity of the step she took, having been persuaded by Garrett Fitzgerald and Dermot Nally and Robert Armstrong, that in effect, unless the Irish government were in with the British government, jointly trying to solve the problem, then it wouldn't be solved. That, of course, was a sour pill for her party members, many of them who simply couldn't tolerate it. But then they looked upon her, you see, with a view that was sometimes, from my point of view, jaundiced. I always remember the damage that she did to British people. When you saw the mounted police battening the people who mined the coal for them and fought the wars for them and left them with a divided society, with a divided families and with a whole social upheaval that she never tried really to solve. And if you look at those things and look what she did in Ireland, I think maybe she did better for Ireland than she did for her own country.
And prior to her conversion, if you like, to the view, as you've explained it, to the idea of giving the Irish government a right and an input into the running of Northern Ireland, there was the whole, I mean, it began in an earlier period of her premiership with the H-Blocks protests, and she saw and watched 10 men die on hunger strike. Now, how did that affect the way politics did or didn't develop as a result?
Well, it had a seminal effect. It's still affecting the way politics are on this island. And the way in which she handled that issue was ham-fisted. It was handled in a way that actually suited, ultimately, the position of the Republican movement, the Provisional IRA. And it created a situation where, at a time when people like ourselves and others were trying to hold the line on peaceful politics, on being part of an agreed solution rather than an imposition, here she was dealing with the hunger strike situation in a way that was simply shoveling support on the ground into the camp of the IRA. She didn't ever seem to be able to realise that when a government starts to act like a paramilitary organisation, then the paramilitary organisation essentially wins.
And of course, there are still big questions that remain unanswered. I mean, one thinks, for instance, of the murder of Pat Finucane, about the way the security forces operated at that time.
Yes, and it was clear at that time. I remember so well Douglas Hogg in a committee actually accepting and stating that he had been told that lawyers in the north of Ireland were partly dealing with the IRA. It was clear from that there was something going on with the police in relation to the legal profession in the north. Of course, Pat Finucane was killed in that, and that brought it right into focus. Problem is that since that, no government has had the courage to face up to dealing with the issue, despite the assurances that were given by Tony Blair in the Western House conference, which took place sometime before the Good Friday Agreement.
Seamus, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Seamus Mallon there on the line from Armagh. You're with the news at 1 on RT Radio 1. Just one big story on this programme today. The death of the woman known as the Iron Lady Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, who was the British Prime Minister from 1979 to 1990, has died at the age of 87. Downing Street has said that she will be accorded the same status of funeral as the Queen Mother and Princess Diana, but will not lie in state in accordance with her own wishes. Joining us now is historian Roy Foster, also Danny Morrison, former publicity director with Sinn Féin, and also Noel Dorr, retired Irish diplomat who served as ambassador to London from 1983 to 87, and also was the secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs from 1987 to 95. Some of those obviously key Thatcher years. But to you first, Roy Foster, how will history judge this woman?
Well, she broke the mould, as was often said, in many ways, both by being the first woman Prime Minister and by, in her view, wrenching the barriers of the state back and beginning the long progress of deregulation and privatisation, in which the Labour Party would later follow her. I mean, like her or loathe her, and the extent to which she was loathed here cannot be underestimated. In certain areas, you've got to say that she is one of the key figures of modern British history in terms of political leadership.
And her admirers would have included one of her subsequent and the most influential of her Labour Party successors, Tony Blair.
Yes, and he often very deliberately proclaimed this, thinking, I think, that this was a key to get a kind of Middle England voting constituency behind him. Her admirers, interestingly, and they still remain her admirers, people who work closely with her, who have written about her. I'm thinking people like Ferdy Mount, Matthew Paris, and Ian Gilmore, who wasn't an admirer but wrote very interestingly about her, always denied that she was the obdurate, unchanging, no U-turn figure that she was claimed to be. They said that in policymaking she was far more flexible and indeed uncertain than her reputation, but she achieved this terrific sort of iron nanny reputation, which played to all sorts of stereotypes and gave her a kind of hold on the national imagination.
Danny Morrison also joins us. Danny Morrison, you were a key figure in Sinn Féin, again, during some of the years of the most bitter conflict with Mrs. Thatcher. You were there, and she was Prime Minister when 10 men died on hunger strike in Longkesh. But it could be said that she was a godsend to Sinn Féin and to the IRA.
Well, that's quite a perverse statement to make. Mrs. Thatcher
in
was
terms
a
of
warmonger.
In terms of recruitment.
No, you're saying we would rather have war than peace? Of course not. It was our community that was suffering, our neighbourhoods that were being devastated by the British Army and by also loyalist paramilitaries who were being ran by her agents in the military. I mean, she was a disaster. I don't know any good that she did. I mean, back in 1970 when she took the milk from the seven-year-old kids in the school, which had been brought in the 1946 Free Milk Act, right up to her coming here and what she did in the H-blocks with those prisoners. I remember clearly 6 months after the death of Bobby Sands, I remember his mother, appealing to Thatcher to save her son and for people to intervene and to save her son. And Bobby Sands, of course, was elected and got more votes than Thatcher got in Finchley. 6 months later, Thatcher's son Mark went missing in the desert. And she appeared on TV distressed, appealing, you know, and praying for people for the life of her son. And she couldn't see, you know, I appreciated the irony at the time. And also, not just in Ireland, but there was the 320 teenage cadets killed on the General Belgrano, which it was 200 miles away from war zone.
Coming back to Northern Ireland, Danny Morrison, was she not the British Prime Minister, the Tory Prime Minister, who effectively broke the Unionist stranglehold on all kinds of change?
Well, I would say that the people who broke that were the people who were out on the streets campaigning against sectarianism and against domination and against inequality. I mean, remember, she did humiliate Gareth Fitzgerald famously.
And he exploited that brilliantly afterwards, didn't he?
The Ireland Forum, which is that's out.
But he did exploit that subsequently. I mean, within a year, less than a year later, he was back delivering the Anglo-Irish Agreement with her.
Yes, but look how long it took before we could actually get a peace process where people's views were respected and where the mandate that Sinn Féin has was actually recognised. I mean, I was elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly for Mid-Ulster, and within a week of being elected, she had excluded me from entering England. If I went to England to speak there on a political matter, I would be jailed for 5 years. She also introduced the censorship laws in 1988. And I would argue that all of these devices and these repressive acts that she initiated had the effect of perpetuating the conflict here and not resolving it. And it wasn't until she was removed, actually, that we got some movement.
John Snow, Channel 4 news presenter, is on the line. John, thanks for joining us. Your reflections or your recollections of Mrs. Thatcher?
My recollections are almost my entire reporting life. I mean, I'm one of those people either unfortunate enough or fortunate enough to have been on deck for her beginning, her middle, and now, sadly, her end. My recollection is that I think she was probably as loved as she was hated. She was as divisive as she was unifying. I think it's very salutary to find myself talking to RT on the heels of a very erudite and very good discussion about her impact on Ireland. You know, whether she understood what she was doing or not, the fact is she was at the very foundation of what became the peace deal, and it was a dramatic thing. And I agree very, very strongly. Gareth Fitzgerald was a brilliant handler of Thatcher. I saw it firsthand. He really had the measure of her, and I think his forbearance, and the word that was used there, was one of the things which brought about the peace between our peoples.
Did she effectively, on the European scene, John, set the tone way back at that Dublin summit at the end of the 70s, shortly after she became Prime Minister, when she came demanding her money back in the form of the British rebate, effectively set the tone for, right up to this day, the general attitude of the British body politic towards Europe?
I think you could certainly lay quite a good deal of that at her door. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think the tone Mrs. Thatcher set was that of being a woman amongst men. And the men were around the table in the European Union just as they were around the table at the cabinet. And men did not know how to handle it, with the single exception of Gareth Fitzgerald. People really did not know Mitterrand. Cole was exasperated by her. She was a menace from their point of view. They just didn't know how to handle her. And I think in many ways that was one of the things which, of course, began to contribute to her own sense of anti-Europeanness. And yet you've got to remember, she signed the Single European Act. She was the person who set in train at least the amount of Europeanness that we have signed up to. And that is an extraordinary thing to be able to say. One of the most anti-European prime ministers that this country has ever had actually did sign the building block to bringing Britain as near as it has come to having a relationship with the rest of Europe.
Now, as we come to the end of the programme, to Peter Bottomley and also to Roy Foster. In a couple of sentences, if you would, you first, Peter Bottomley, her best points, her worst points.
Her best point, as Noel's pointed out, was her flexibility. And she might approach a problem with a clear view, but if people could stand up and put the arguments for something different and better, she'd often go for it. And the last thing I really want to say is that those of us who know her will be able to talk about her personal generosity in a way which you can't say for many other prime ministers. And John Major was like that, Gareth Fitzgerald was like that. And I think that as Noel, who is a great continuity man, has said, she could get on with people like Charles Haughey, which was important for all of us.
And Roy Foster?
Well, again, the flexibility, which Noel mentioned, I think was remarkable and important. Those of us who lived in England when she was prime minister and had to put up with trying to educate children and against this barrage of cuts, those of us who didn't agree with a great many of her domestic policies could still rather almost admire the way she wrong-footed people. The Falklands, for instance, which we haven't perhaps talked about enough, she wrong-footed the left cleverly on because they were left in the position of having to defend General Galtieri. If she's to be remembered in British politics, she would probably have rather liked to have been remembered as a Disraeli-type figure, the outsider who comes in and tries to change things. In fact, she didn't, I think, have his kind of qualities. She's more like Robert Peel, the ideologue who wasn't much liked and indeed cordially disliked by very many people, but who could essentially, as he did on the Corn Laws, change his mind and change the direction of Britain with it.
Roy Foster and Peter Bottomley, thank you both for joining us on the line. Last word to you, Noel Dorr. Was she primarily a divider?
I suppose it's been said she was both a divider and a uniter. I can't really think of her as a uniter. I'm not sure that I would have voted for her if I were British, but I think her role is a historic one. And I think in relation to Ireland, too, it's a historic one. Perhaps even in relation to Europe, in not in necessarily a good sense, but you said that, or I think John Snow said, that she had set the bottom line for the degree of Europeanness that the British government today displays. And
I think that's an elegant way of summarising what I was trying to say. Noel Doerr, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Former senior Irish diplomat and former ambassador to London and Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs. Brings us to the end of this extended edition of the News at One.